you want a vision of the future, Winston, imagine a boot stamping on a human face forever.
You want answers?
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth! You can't handle the truth!
Someone is trying to teach me a lesson in futility. Why am I the only one who isn't killed?
They will run you dizzy. They will pile falsehood on top of falsehood until you can't tell a lie from the truth and you won't even want to. That's how the powerful keep their power. Don't you read the papers?
The world is a college of corporations, inexorably determined by the immutable bylaws of business. The world is a business, Mr. Beale.
It has been since man crawled out of the slime.
Welcome to another episode of Our Interesting Times. It is my pleasure to have John Q. Publius back on the show. He's here to discuss the current turmoil in the context of this COVID-19 pandemic, scandemic operation, however you choose to look at it. I know he's also recently published two books, The God That Failed, Liberalism and the Destruction of the West, and The Way Life Should Be, The Globalist Demographic War on America with Maine as a Microcosm. John, how are you doing this evening?
I am doing very well. How about you?
Very well, thank you. Of course, you are the host of the Anatomically Correct Banana. And
yes.
Also, you host that website, of course, and your podcast is The Cocktail Hour.
So The Cocktail Hour, things moved very quickly here, but actually, interestingly, you have the distinction of being the second to last guest, or pair of guests with Theo, I believe, came on with us.
Did my show kill it? No.
No, I've actually, this is somewhat related, but I'm actually launching a new podcast called The Way Life Should Be without the question mark on Tom Kaczynski's Free Atlantic Radio channel.
Oh, okay.
Which will be a couple days, within a couple days should be up.
Okay, does that mean I can take the name of the Cocktail Hour? No.
Yeah, if you want to. It's the domain name is now available. It's up for grabs.
I like that name, that's why.
It's a great name. Yeah. I mean, it really is a great name. I just kind of hit on it by dumb luck. I was watching a rerun of that movie, Swingers, and I was like, oh my God, this is perfect. It's like, you know, you're really cozy, chilling, everyone having a glass of scotch or wine, hanging out, talking about stuff, but... with the way things have accelerated, it's sort of like, okay, you know, I love the coziness, but you know, I don't know if it serves things in you know, year zero. That
yeah. That's right. Yeah, the new era, the new normal, year zero, the new normal. Okay, well, right now we seem to be in a situation now where governments, the mainstream media, are kind of creating an ongoing crisis, open-ended, with this pandemic. It ebbs, you know, ebbs. It's kind of, it waxes and it wanes. It was kind of dying out the end of May, and then we had the George Floyd incident, and that sparked all these protests and riots, and then also in America was introduced into this sort of nationwide struggle session. And that's a good term because it was very much, and it continues to be very much kind of like the Cultural Revolution in China in the 1960s and early 70s. But then, lo and behold, the pandemic comes back and we're hearing about spiking cases with this test that they're running, that, you know, that apparently tests are spiking or positive tests are spiking. And now that's a pretext for phase two of the lockdown or slowing down the reopening. Various states are doing this, California, New York, Michigan. There's the cult of the mask now, whereas when you're in the most when we were in the most lethal phase of the pandemic, masks weren't required. Now they are required. At least they claim to be required. There's a lot of problems there. It's almost, again, it's become almost like a ritual. And these are indeed strange times. In the meantime, you have this book, The God That Failed, Liberalism and the Destruction of the West. And on the back, it says, something's not right. All around us, society seems to be sinking into decay, and we don't recognize, let alone even know, the people living right next door to us. The media sells illusory progress with the latest gadgets and fads, and for all the talk of social justice, there's scant justice to be had. Alienation, violence, dereliction, and despair fester as the wounds turn septic and the people are literally sick to death. The nameless system of neoliberalism is the worst of both worlds, a government willing to play God, going so far as to generate an entirely new population amenable to their designs, a global population of rootless producers and consumers, and an oligarchic set of international bankers and businessmen who've seen to it that the game is rigged in their favor. This is a system of irreconcilable contradictions, one that peddles equality but produces the greatest material disparity. It peddles liberty while crushing all dissent. It celebrates diversity but is soul-crushingly uniform. Its illusory progress looks more like a medieval fiefdom than the always just out of reach utopia that the charlatans promise is just around the corner, with one more concession, always more until there's nothing left. The God That Failed will drag the hideous, nameless system into the light and expose its hypocrisy, lies, and destruction. Did you write that?
I did, actually, yes.
Very, very nice.
Thank you. Thank you. Yeah, I'm an above average podcaster, but I can turn a phrase. That's really my gift.
Now, this is interesting because it almost seems like we're out of the consumption phase, the mass consumption phase. And now we're heading into sort of austerity. Of course, they're blaming the virus, but they've managed to shut down almost the entire West, the economic West, the industrialized world, supposedly to fight this virus. And it created, at least in the United States, up towards what, 40 million unemployed overnight, and we're still lingering with this. And we have a political leadership which either feckless or is determined, seems to keep the economy underwater, ground down, while they, you know, shadow box with this virus. I tend to look at this thing holistically. I think COVID-19, the riots, the protests, it's all related. Would you agree?
Yeah, I would. It's actually, I'm of the mind that the riots were designed initially, at least, to distract from the consolidation of power, particularly with BlackRock and some of these big financial firms basically acquiring stake, basically becoming the government. I mean, this has been an ongoing process with the Federal Reserve, but it's gotten so ridiculous now. And I think that while all that was going on, and as you mentioned, the fact that the economy, particularly the low and mid-level businesses, the mom and pops, the non-corporatized world, let's call it, was basically just annihilated. They pretty much just wiped out all the competition. So it pretty much is the realization of what I wrote for the little blurb on the back of the book. And I do agree with you, the hyper-consumption phase. And unfortunately, that's the thing about the books, right? Like when you put a book out, things move so much faster than... but I think that the general principles still hold, particularly in the latter half when I get into the economics. I talk about different population groups and why they're cultivated and curried to as opposed to others. And I think that even as we enter a kind of more austere and less hyper-consumption sort of phase, who knows if that will come back, if this is just a trial run or something to that effect, or if this is, they really do realize they're running out of resources and they have to start kind of ratcheting back. They still want strict input outputs. They still want all the money that whatever meager earnings people can take in to go right back into the economic machine. So if it's, it may not be just to the bonanza that it was the last, I don't know, 20 years or so, but I still think that that's something that they want. But it could be a lot of the excess stuff stripped away, but you still have the massive borderline monopoly. Well, definitely not borderline, definitely monopolies with some of these things. I forget the exact term for what it is when it's like a couple of sellers, but it's, you know what I'm talking about. But anyway, they pretty much have total control over the economy now, and the government's just been totally willing to allow itself to be an asset in the portfolio of your BlackRock's and such, and then hand over control of the economy to Amazon and Walmart and all that stuff.
Yeah, there's been a great consolidation that's occurred with this crisis. The COVID-19, you know, the lockdown has resulted in sort of a lot of assets or wealth being sucked upwards into these corporations and away from, you know, the middle part of the economy, this mom and pop operations, localized businesses. So you have further concentration. It's something you always seem to get with these crises, whether it's war or Great Depressions, which leads some people to believe these things are engineered. Of course, the mechanism is there for that very thing, that sort of financial coup. And of course, going back to 2008, recently you interviewed Nick Griffin on your last Cocktail interview, and he talked about how a lot of this is a hangover from 2008 because none of the problems were resolved. They were papered over. And, you know, the criminals, the people who were responsible for the crash in 2008 got bailed out. And this is 10 years now of unsustainable debt. At the same time, they've created a demographic situation which isn't sustainable either. So you have economic growth or prosperity with a declining population and exploding debt. So it's like they've intentionally created these internal contradictions.
Yeah, they have, and that was a phenomenal interview. I'm going to probably repost it or republish it rather at some point. With The Way Life Should Be, because it's one that really everyone needs to listen to, where he talks about how this has really been a lot of the trends we've been seeing coming to a head. And I think absolutely it's this kind of new police state, this new normal that they're constantly hammering. It doesn't change the model. I think that this was always something that they were aware of on the horizon. And actually, I've been doing some digging into, you know, the roots of the financial crisis and the housing and stuff. And, you know, I think older listeners will remember the dot-com bubble bursting in, and I think it was the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So that was going on, and that was never really resolved either. So you have basically the hand in glove, the whole thing that's been going on. And every time the system hits some kind of a snag, which it needs to be running seamlessly, because it relies on so many moving parts. And it's kind of one of those strange things because a lot of people have said maybe it's anti-fragile, it's omnipresent. I mean, yes, but by the same token, one little monkey wrench in the gears can cause things to grind to a total halt. And we're seeing, again, whether or not they wanted the virus to get out to be used or to what degree it's been exaggerated or engineered. I mean, we know that they were funding research into that. The U.S. government was funding research into that lab in China. Mm-hmm. So has this been a trial run, or was it unintentionally released and they weren't, they were taking a page from the George W. Bush era, never letting a good crisis go to waste. You know, it's the same thing that got minds spinning 20 years ago about stuff, right? Like, to what degree was there foreknowledge of this? To what degree has it been seized upon? Did they know this was going to happen? And this is kind of like they wanted to see what was going on. I mean, for sure, if you talk to frontline medical professionals, they'll say they definitely do see this stuff. It's sort of been described as like a lung AIDS, and my impression is it's very similar. Like I don't know if there's any proof behind this or not. I haven't really dug into it. But I'm pretty sure HIV is probably generated in a lab somewhere. So it's probably the same thing. We know Lyme disease was in a lab somewhere. So whether these things get out unintentionally or they intentionally shoot them into a particular population and kind of, again, they're unafraid to play God. So who knows where that all kind of one thing ends and another thing begins. But there's no question that the need to shut everything down is grossly overblown. Really, what should have been done in the first place, if it was indeed an outbreak in Wuhan, was just isolate Wuhan. I mean, it's basic common sense. But, you know, that clearly can't stand, you know, because that's racist or something. So if it gets out and it starts spreading, then at the very least, simply isolate the elements of the population that are going to be more susceptible to it. But no, we need to have these weird and irrational draconian, like you mentioned about the mask. And the other thing, too, because you had mentioned the struggle session. One thing I've been hearing a lot about lately is these kind of people calling out, quote unquote, Karens. And it's like this thing, okay, like you don't see a woman wearing a mask. Well, she becomes an object of derision and attack. And so we've been saying for a long time, this isn't, by the way, an I told you so, but we've been saying for a long time, these women who think that they're kind of doing the virtuous thing by throwing in with this so-called coalition of the ascendant, I call it the island of misfit toys, they are actually now moving on to the next phase where they've pretty much, in their minds, sufficiently demolished white guys. They have not, and there's plenty of fight left in us, as you and I talking here reveals, and much more. But this is kind of the next stage in that. So the next stage is to start attacking these quote-unquote Karens, which they're using as a racial slur.
Yeah, there's actually a Karen Act in, I think, California, Oakland, California.
Yeah, I saw that. Yeah, it's pretty brazen. I mean, seriously.
I mean, it's almost like, what if there was a Sambo Act or something to address some, right. The problem of black crime somewhere. And it is, this is coming off. There was an article, was it the Washington Post, New York Times, that said that white women should be glad that we're only, that we're not asking for revenge, as if white women are responsible for anti-black violence, I guess, because of, women in the history of women accusing black men of assault, because we all know, it's hyped that black men never assault white women. It's the other way around, if you watch Hollywood movies. But, meaning that they're white guys assaulting black women, although statistically that doesn't even appear in the FBI crime statistics. But, this is the myth that's been created, that the lynchings, problems were brought about because of alleged sexual assault by black men, or affronts, when a woman was affronted by a black man's whistle or something. And of course the story of Emmett Till and these things,
right?
And also
actually comes up in the book.
Okay, but even the Tulsa riots, which which actually is much more convoluted than the standard history accounts tell, in the 1920 Tulsa riots. But the fact that they were like just blaming white women, and this also with the 1619 Project that is being sponsored by the New York Times, the country's paper of record, with this character, Hannah Jones is her name? Is that her name? Mm-hmm. Well, she's produced this tendentious, historical analysis where the only history that matters in America is race, particularly white versus black or black versus white. And America was founded in 1619, and it was built upon the backs and labor of blacks, and no one else really participated in it. What this shows is that this anti-white and this white guilt meme or theme was being stoked for years prior to most recent events. So they were seeding the ground for this type of reaction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, obviously, I'm biased as a New Englander against such an interpretation, and I know any Southerners will strenuously object to the same thing for their own reasons. It's like, okay, well, we first put roots here in 1607 in Maine, and then they that was aborted because the winter was so harsh. And they came back in 1620, but like, the idea that that's only a very small segment of Southern society. That's, the listeners know all this stuff. That you have the development of the two different things. So, if the North, if the original sin is of the United States is cheap labor, well, in the North, they're perfectly happy to use 7-year-olds to grind to pieces in factories and stuff. That is a much more concerning thing, and that's a much more legitimate argument than, this garbage that, that a very small percentage of the population used people, to pick crops or whatever. I mean, it's just asinine.
Quentin Tarantino hasn't made a movie about, kids being abused in factories in the north. So, so they've, Hollywood has yet to really portray that, at least moralistic, in a sort of a moralistic theme. This way they've done, you know, with slavery. And of course, right, it's only that Western, particularly slavery in the United States, which seems to get that treatment, whereas the fact that slavery, you know, existed throughout all ages and throughout the world, and in the United States, what distinguished the peculiar institution was its relative benign nature, if I may say. I mean, that's just the truth. Relative to all other countries, it was relatively benign and humane. And I emphasize the word relative. That's just the truth. And that's why in 1807 they were able to end the slave trade, because the Negro population was so prodigious owing to the relatively high standard of living in the United States relative to the rest of the world, particularly in their home country, Africa, which was, you know, chieftains were more than happy to sell their brothers to slave
traders. Right, yeah, exactly.
You know?
Yeah, it's just preposterous. And then if you look at the the Islamic slave trade, which is obviously infinitely worse, or I always get people with this. I say, you know, hey, look at a map of Europe, right? How many major cities in Europe are on the coast? Zero, so far as I can think, other than Lisbon. And there's a reason for that. They're called Barbary pirates and Vikings. So like the other ones that are on the coast, I guess, would be the Scandinavian ones. Like pretty much all the other major cities are inland, at least a little bit. So it's like, well, why do you think that is? You know, but people that, you know, there's this whole idea of like becoming aware of, you know, the history of things. It's like, actually, it's just even more of a distortion than anything else, you know. And it's like they're trying to take these fringe figures and elevate them to the, you know, this tremendous status of like, I remember this a little bit when I was a kid, when we learned about the revolution. They talked about the Crispus Attucks, like he was some, like the guy's claim to fame was that he got shot, you know. Like, oh, cool, great hero, you know. You know what I mean? So Franz Ferdinand's a hero too, I guess. Yeah. Like what? So anyway, but yeah, all this ideological stuff, and actually in The God That Failed, that's really what I wanted to break it down for. So they're kind of like two sides of the same coin. So I actually eventually I'm going to do six books in this. It's kind of like a series. Each will address some aspect of the system as it exists and the aims and things that they're going for, but with The God That Failed, it's really a bird's eye view, and then it zooms in on a couple instances to illustrate. And I basically break down neoliberalism into the ideological and the economic categories. And they're inextricable from each other, but to try, you know, I wanted to try to make it as digestible as possible. Now, the listener, if they pick this book up, they'll probably be familiar with a lot of the ideological stuff. The economic stuff, I think, is a little bit more advanced that I have in there. And certainly the conclusion gets into a lot of metapolitical stuff and also some practical solutions. So kind of it really ticks a lot of boxes and it touches a lot of bases. It's kind of a self-contained book in that sense. But if you really want the fine-grained detail on how the immigration thing works, but also a bit presaging the COVID stuff that we've been talking about in terms of consolidating resources, Chapter 5 from The Way Life Should Be talks about that privatization and resource consolidation in the book, they talks about water. I talk about water as a resource, but there are other resources too. They're doing the same thing. That one is more of like a microcosm, which you can then extrapolate and zoom outward. So they're kind of like in similar ways, highlighting the system and showing how these things work and how they're trying to bring all these people in and have this economic model predicated on exponential growth and all of those things. But they take very different perspectives in the sense that one is like more of a bird's eye view and one of them's more ground up and focuses on that really granular detail down to the localities in Maine, particularly, although I do talk about other places, not just in New England, but beyond, but Maine is the focus. And from there, my hope is that the reader is able to go, okay, well, here's how it's done in Maine, which has a very relatively small population. And it's much easier to outline the things when you're dealing with a little over a million people as opposed to if I went for California, say. And it's also very recent in Maine. It really only starts accelerating after the turn of the millennium. And it's what's called a secondary pull factor, a secondary migration. The Somalis coming up from Georgia. So they actually were originally in Georgia, this community that Jared Howes talked a lot about in Lewiston, that I would describe it more as a tumor. But that starts there, and it basically builds up this community, this no-go zone, beachhead, whatever you want to call it. And then from there it can grow. And that's what they're doing with the refugee resettlement, is they're trying to artificially create these enclaves in 90%+ white areas. If you look per capita, it's all like Boise, Idaho, Fargo, North Dakota, Maine, upstate New York, New Hampshire, Michigan, Minnesota is the famous one. And that's what they're doing. And so once there's a significant beachhead, then they pull and they bring in more Somalis, and word of mouth spreads and that kind of thing. So I try to outline how the whole thing works. So ideally by the end of it, the reader is like, all right, this is exactly what they do. And even if it's not the one organization, it's one of those types of organizations, and it's replicated. And then they can take matters into their own hands and start focusing on their immediate surroundings, their locality, and say, all right, you are trying to do this to us. We know the game. We're going to push back against this.
Mm-hmm. And it's important to point out, I'm sure the book does, because I'm familiar with the article. I haven't the series of articles that you wrote last year regarding this very issue, is that there are definitely organizations and individuals that are implementing these policies. I mean, after all, you know, you talk about Somalia. People from Somalia and Georgia, they didn't make a great trek, you know, across the Atlantic, across the African continent, across the Atlantic Ocean, and up in Georgia, they were shipped there, and that requires resources and airplanes and then buses, and all the stuff is being financed and paid for by a certain group to achieve a certain political objective by manipulating the demographics of certain areas.
Yeah, absolutely, and it takes a variety of forms, and that's where it gets a little bit convoluted and a little bit complicated, is a lot of the stuff too is more of a hybrid form. So they call it I sarcastically call it philanthropic capitalism. It's where they basically take in charity as this end around, and they're using it as a means to get these people in. And, you know, you get, like, depending on what type of donation and stuff, it's up 30% up to fully tax write off. You know, the parishioners at different churches, and they're giving money to these charities. And instead of going and helping Joe Sixpack next door, who's down on his luck, they go and they just drag people from the most diametrically opposed cultures possible and just dump them off in your neighborhood, even though you've said repeatedly, could you please not do this? Mm-hmm. So, you know, so we're getting to a point now, the flashpoints, it's like, okay, well, we have requested, we have voted for people that said that they were going to stop this. No one has, and we're not asking anymore. You know, we're telling you enough's enough. And with the difficulty here, though, is, and as I outline in the book, is the, and it gets a little Byzantine, this whole campaign finance thing. I try to outline it as clearly as possible, but the gist of it is that they're all bought and sold, right? So you're not getting anyone in there. That was the whole appeal of Trump, is that he was perceived anyway to be an outsider. And that was the appeal of, okay, well, everyone pretty much knows the politicians have ground to a halt, the inertia, they're all in on it. So maybe Trump comes in and shakes things up as somewhat of an outsider. And obviously that's not happened by any means. You know, I jokingly said the other day, I wanted Pat Buchanan and I got James Buchanan. I mean, that's pretty much where we're at, though. It's like full on disintegration at the moment.
Yeah,
maybe that's not so bad, though. Yeah. You know, I mean, maybe the project, this isn't really the topic of the episode, so I don't want to get too far afield on this, but maybe that's the way that America was always destined to go, is it was kind of a Roman Empire. And out of this, you get, you know, New England is Slovenia and the Mid-Atlantic is Croatia and whatever, you know, you get different countries, nations that are born out of it, true nations.
Well, I mean, the way it's currently governed from the center, or misgoverned from the center, the nation is simply too big, and perhaps despite the problematic nature of its creation, I'm talking about, you know, the Freemasonic origins of the country and the philosophy behind it and the promises, you know, all men are created equal. It's nice, touchy, flowery language, but it's a promise that can't be kept, because the state of things is actually inequality and differences. But it, at the very least, it was a decentralized republic, and it was more manageable. And as it became an empire of liberty under, you know, the boot of Lincoln and the Civil War, and became centralized, it became increasingly less viable. It's just a question of time. I mean, we're sort of seeing the reduction ad absurdum of sort of the American empire today under liberalism and its promises. One thing it did have, though, going in, at least into the middle part of the 20th century, was demographic stability, a very large European-based, you know, population. And so you had a large degree of cultural cohesion despite its differences. Obviously, those differences were profound. The unpleasantness of the 1860s demonstrates that. But nevertheless, there was sort of an agreement that was made in the latter part of the 19th century. And up until the 1950s and 60s, it's, with the demographics and, of course, with the post-war boom, it seemed to work. But it was short-lived because it was undercut in the 1960s, not only with the Civil Rights Act, the Civil Rights Revolution, really. This is sort of a revolution of the constitutional order. Christopher Caldwell writes about this in his book, The Age of Entitlement. It was a completely different political order that was created in the 1960s. But it was smoothed over because the country was still close to 90% white. But I think you've talked about in the mid-60s, of course, even although it didn't get as much publicity, it was in 1965, you had the Hart-Celler Act. And that set the stage for today's weaponized immigration into the country, which is openly talked about now as being pursued to dilute the white majority.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's celebrated, and that was at work for a while, you know. And Kevin MacDonald, who wrote the foreword actually to The Way Life Should Be, which is quite an honor actually, has talked about this, about the kind of prolonged and sustained effort by these people to undercut, you know, the traditional ethnic makeup, and you know, things tend toward entropy, and particularly when it's an empire like the U.S. And the kind of the last gasp of the, let's call them socially conscious or patriotic WASPs in the 20s, who are, you know, I don't consider WASP, by the way, to be a derogatory term. But to me, it sounds like lethal and kind of cool. It's like somebody's kind of badass who come sting you and fly off, you know, like I think it's a cool term. But anyway, I know some people think it's an insult, but these guys, the Madison Grant, Lothrop Stoddard, these are Harvard guys. These are New England, old school, Anglo-Saxons who are basically using their intellect to push through meaningful policy change first in 1921 and then becomes enshrined in 24. And then, yeah, you have Celler, who basically not as talked about. I forget the exact name of the act. I want to say it's 1946, like pretty much immediately after World War II. Gets an act pushed through which allows for a path to naturalization for Indians and Filipinos in the 40s. So there was some subversion. I mean, there was a lot of subversion, but along those lines anyway, immediately following World War II, from this guy who was incessantly trying to chip away at the safeguards that were in place. But if it's, as you mentioned, if it's an ideological thing, if it's a series of ideas or propositions, and it's a whole host of issues with the founding of the country, you know, you can only basically keep the wolves at bay. You're never going to be able to say, like, we are Slovenian, we are Croatian, we are Hungarian. And it's a very clear sense of who that is, and there's a very clear sense of who that is not. And for America, it's just become, it probably was always somewhat flexible, but it's definitely now completely untenable.
Yes, yeah. And yeah, it's the function of pluralism or diversity, and it's there to create a sort of a divided, you know, atomized society, so the elites can rule over them, the oligarchs. It's interesting because if you look at Hart-Celler and also the Civil Rights Act of 1964, Hart-Celler 1965, with the Civil Rights Act, I think a promise was made that despite passing these laws, it was assumed that you could do away with 250 years of segregation, of Jim Crow, and all the cultural differences that these customs and laws represented. You could just, with a swipe of a pen, do away with them, and that was it. And the this is how the North saw it, though, because the North, when it's talked about racism, they didn't think of themselves as being guilty. They were kind of pointing the finger at the South, the conquered provinces of the South. And so when the Civil Rights Act was passed and Martin Luther King became a celebrated national figure, although it's still controversial, it was the North sort of looking down at the South and saying, this is for you. But it was immediately turned against the North because one of the things that people were concerned about was that the Civil Rights Act would inevitably lead to things like quotas, racial quotas, and affirmative action. In fact, an explicit promise was made that it wouldn't. And almost before the ink was dry on the act, the courts and the federal bureaucracy that was charged with enforcing the laws started making it a requirement to attain the objectives of the Civil Rights Act. It was statistical disparity. These things were used as a sort of a prima facie case for discrimination. Therefore, the only way companies could avoid being sued and being presumed guilty of these things was to impose quotas, racial quotas. So you got the racial quotas. But it's funny because both in Hart-Celler too, when they signed, President Johnson signed the Hart-Celler Act, those who said it was going to disrupt the demographics of the country were poo-pooed as being conspiracy theorists. I don't know if that term was used, was being alarmist. No, we promised to maintain the demographic balance of the country, admitting that back then, at least they gave such a concern lip service. Now, today, if you express concern about the demographics of the country, the declining white population, the influx of non-Westerners into the country and its effects, its economic, political effects, you're called a racist. But that was... they promised when they passed the darn law that it wouldn't have the effect. The very
right. Yeah.
So, I mean, it's kind of funny. Both laws, you know, they promised we wouldn't get, but we got exactly what the naysayers said was going to happen with those laws. And they've since been vindicated.
Yeah. I mean, that's always the way it is, yeah. Right? It's like, and I say this in The God That Failed, it's basically like whatever they're saying. And I know Tucker Carlson has said this too, actually. It's the exact opposite.
Yeah.
So it's one of those things. This is how the system functions. It's all misdirection. It's all in the shadows. It's never calling a spade a spade. You know, they say liberal democracy, but really what they mean is just extremely draconian censorship, which, by the way, I experienced very rapidly after publishing these books. The God That Failed was banned off of Amazon, I think, within a month. And The Way Life Should Be was banned off of Barnes & Noble as of last week. So we're peeling it. But
oh, so I got a copy before they banned it. So I yep. ordered it from Barnes & Noble.
Yep. So the God That Failed, Amazon said, quote, it did not offer a satisfactory consumer experience.
So.
Oh.
I don't know. Maybe I'm not as good as I think I am. But I have something. I have a feeling it probably has something to do with the conclusions that I made. And... you know, the tone of the thing, because neither book is incendiary. I'm not going around calling people names or anything like that. I'm laying out a very, in my opinion, obviously strong case with evidence. It's very factual and matter of fact. I do make a moral and ethical case as well. It's done in the, and this is obviously what they're trying to destroy. It's done in the classical Western fashion of, look, here's rhetoric and composition. Here's how you frame the argument. And here's how you put pen to paper and try to persuade people, and it's like that. There's no name calling or anything like that. I might make the odd joke or something, but that's not why it was banned. It's banned because it makes inconvenient truths known, and it genuinely, the whole, you know, oh, we speak truth to power thing. It's like, well, if you did, then you'd be experiencing what I experience, which is having a site you used to write for deplatformed, having your books banned and being shadow banned and all the rest of it. Like, you know, that's what's going on here. And I'm knock on wood, I'm surprised it hasn't been worse. I'm sure it will be at some point, but, what they don't realize is it just emboldens me. I'm just going to go harder. You know, it's not going to stop.
Well, as you say, yeah, liberalism peddles liberty while crushing all dissent, you know, and
yeah, it's a joke. I mean, you know, could I make a good living writing, you know, trash for BuzzFeed that, you know, a bot could do? Yeah, probably. But, you know, I have to look at myself in the mirror. I mean, anyone who works for BuzzFeed or has worked for BuzzFeed is probably at best a mediocrity. And that's the thing. The system rewards mediocrity, again, at best mediocrity. So these people who pass judgment on us, like they're at best, they're okay at what they do. And more often than not, they're completely useless people who that's why they so strongly protect their position in this inverted hierarchy, because in a real world, in a properly functioning society, these people are a laughingstock.
Well, if we were living in a white supremacist society where you and I enjoyed white male privilege, we wouldn't be censored at all. We would value
objectivity and merit.
Yeah, that, or given the accusations of the other side, we'd at least be given sinecures, right? Because we'd all be because it's a white supremacist system. Why wouldn't we reward ourselves? If it's a white supremacist system, why am I not rewarded for my whiteness?
Right. Yeah. Why do I have to use an assumed identity so that I don't lose my job? And,
yeah. Why do we both have to use fake names?
Yeah. Exactly. super supremacist. And why is it that, you know, there's no money in this for anybody too? Like, let's take the most nakedly obvious thing. Like these people are not intelligent people for the most part. They're outer party anyway. They're inner party. They're smart, but they're outer party. The people screeching about all this stuff. Well, if that were the case, would we not be raking in the bucks and you know, living on yachts and all the other stuff? Like, you know, no, of course not. And that's just the most obvious materialist thing that you could, you know, smack these people in the face with, metaphorically speaking, is like, okay, well, let's say that there's a correlation between income and power and whatever else. Like, where is that then? Why are we doing what we do in the way that we do? Why are we not all living large and, you know, paying off phalanxes of people to go harass you? Where are paid protesters? No, I'm just kidding. But like, where are all these other things, you know, if you want to just look at it from that nakedly superficial perspective? But I mean, there's way more to it, obviously. But it's
we be able to like run seminars in corporations that, teach about people how to celebrate their whiteness and how to teach me how to discriminate against blacks and running seminars or like, was that lady D'Angelo who wrote the book White Fragility? Well, you know, why aren't we making $20,000 a speech or, you know, and having books being bought by universities and corporations so they can indoctrinate and instill white guilt in people? You know, it's laughable to even make that accusation at this point.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And like, I don't even, you know, I've intentionally tried not to engage with this D'Angelo as much as possible, because I'm sure at some point it'll become mandatory reading or you lose your job or something. I mean, they're already going. Kevin MacDonald had tweeted about this. A lot of the colleges and universities are making you sign loyalty oaths. A lot of corporations and different businesses are making you do these extra trainings to do with gender identity and bias and all these other things. I can't imagine it's more than 6 months away from everybody who has a white collar job having to read. I keep wanting to say Beverly D'Angelo from the
actress. Yeah.
Yeah. From the National Lampoon films, but Robin D'Angelo.
Yeah.
And 2 years from every stonemason and welder having to read it. That's my prediction at the current rate anyway.
Yeah. That's of all things continue at a pace. You'd have to think, just naturally, there'd be a reaction to this. But the one thing that stands out about this revolution is that it's sponsored by Coca-Cola. It's sponsored by, you know, Bank of America, Google, Nike. It's a corporate sponsored revolution, which then belies its nature. It's obviously not a revolution. It's a fomented turmoil. It's being manipulated by the powers that be, as most usually are. Black Lives Matter being lavished with corporate funding and foundation funding, despite the fact that really, I mean, if the government was really doing its job, this organization could be indicted as an interstate criminal operation. I mean, it's same with Antifa too.
The fundraising arm is what run by some Jewish lady who used to be in the Weather Underground and got a pardon along with Mark Rich and all these guys. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, come on. And I wrote an article about that actually for the Occidental Observer, just outlining where a lot of these BLM adjacent organizations were getting their money from. And it's exactly as you say, it's the Coca-Colas and all that. One really good book that listeners might want to consider is my, I guess you call him my Black House Publishing roommate, would be Carrie Bolton's Babel Inc.
I have that. Yeah,
that's a great book. It really outlines a lot of what
he also did. Revolution from Above too.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. He's a beast. I mean, he writes just phenomenal stuff. And you know, that book, Revolution from Above, these books are tremendous. And he's got his own website too, which has some great stuff on it, and it outlines this, like, you know, Coca-Cola revolution it's ridiculous, you know, but that is, in fact, you're right. That is, in fact, what's happening.
Well, it's a corporate operation. And that's one thing that kind of confuses a lot of people, because if you look at people who still believe in the right-left, you know, paradigm, Republican versus Democrat, liberals, they think the cities are bad because it's run by liberals.
You know, yeah, exactly.
As if it's liberal. Well, New York City has been run by liberals forever, and it was livable despite everything, right? Because there's a sort of an understanding how things run there. We can see how the difference being run by a liberal and someone being run by a Bolshevist. And what Bolshevism is it's Bolshevism. It's a form of political terror. It's a form of Jewish political cultural terror, and we're seeing that in part of the struggle session is this weird. Politicians seem dedicated. Local politicians seem dedicated to actually destroying the cities and states that they've been elected to preside or oversee. We see this with the lockdown in Michigan or here, in New York or in Virginia. And it seems to be more of a blue state thing. They seem to be more dedicated. And this might gets us into what's going on here is that in the past few years, and some people have undercovered that George Soros' Open Society Foundation has been funding local elections. And almost to a man or to a woman, every DA that's causing trouble, like this idiot down in St. Louis, Karen Gardner, or this, who's the guy, Krasner in Philadelphia, the one in Chicago, they've all received hundreds of thousands of dollars. That's a lot of money for a local election to get them elected as DAs. And now these local DAs are acting as sort of Bolshevist Discordian agents, where they're not going after rioters, but they are going after particularly white people who have the temerity to defend themselves when they're set upon. The DA in Albuquerque is going after the guy who defended himself with a gun when he was set upon by a mob that was tearing down a statue of a conquistador in Albuquerque. And the newspaper says they were protesting. No, they're actually tearing it down. And they were, you know, this guy was chased by them. One of his assailants had a knife, and he warned him to back off. Then he fired off a couple of rounds to defend himself. He's being prosecuted, but his assailants aren't. And, of course, we're familiar with that case in St. Louis. This is Karen Gardner. I think at the time when she was appointed DA, although it was a Democratic-run office, dozens of people resigned because of her incompetence. They were just shocked by it. But apparently they've been installed to do the very thing that we're seeing. Jacob Fry in Minneapolis, a good example, is these are agents of discord. They're there to create havoc and turmoil and sort of carry out an economic and political warfare against their constituents.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's not just in the U.S. I mean, he's been doing this forever, but you're absolutely right. It's in Europe, they get their Central European University scholarships, and then they go out and they do the same thing. They take these posts and they're agents of upheaval. And it should be enough to make anyone lose faith in the government and its ability to weed anybody out and to actually protect anything. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, it's kind of like, okay, well, this American project, we can see it was in a lot of ways in retrospect doomed to fail, right? Hindsight being 2020. It's particularly bad now. It doesn't make it any less unpleasant to live through. The people, though, the good thing about this, if we can say that is, in fact, if we're trying to find silver linings, is that, you know, this egregious incompetence is plain for everyone to see. And the fact that they are purely ideologically motivated, these people who are in these positions, yeah, their actions benefit the bottom lines of all the corporatocracy as well, obviously. But their naked partisanship, their flagrant disregard, this is creating a huge group of people who are becoming dissidents, or you could even say revolutionaries, counter-revolutionaries, I guess, who are aware of the fact that their government in plain sight has been subverted and is working to destroy them. I mean, the arguments we've made for years and years and years make themselves in the presence of a Jacob Frey or this Gardner or, excuse me, any of these other
De Blasio, types. Cuomo, yeah.
De Blasio, right, exactly, De Blasio. Tucker's done a great job of highlighting the governors who have gone out of their way to destroy the odd small business owner who defies orders to try and make a living.
Yeah, that was the governor in Maine.
The governor of Maine did that, absolutely. And, you know, we're trying to find some, apparently there's some letters that exist where she was threatening people and saying, you know, with my power as AG, I'm going to destroy you and that kind of stuff. So we're trying to verify and authenticate copies of those letters that have been rumored, because obviously we want to bring her down, because she's just a sociopathic lunatic. And the whole power structure, as I mentioned, in the way life should be in Maine, you wouldn't think, right? Like, of all places, Maine, that Maine's going to have this deeply corrupt Tammany Hall, worse than Tammany, I make Tammany Hall blush, type of political establishment. But
yeah, I think Boss Tweed has some local patriotisms.
Right. These people are just reprehensible from every possible
Daley. I think however corrupt Daley was, I think he liked Chicago.
He didn't, right, exactly. Yeah, these people hate where they live. Yeah. They hate their neighbors. They hate everyone. You know, and it's the same everywhere, obviously. And I could have chosen Minnesota. I could have chosen Idaho. I could have chosen anywhere. But, you know, Maine, for various reasons, if people read the book, they'll see why I chose it. But it's, you know, it's Mills who was declining to prosecute these people when she was the AG. It's the senators, it's the representatives, it's even the local politicians. The media is all controlled. The media there is all controlled by one guy, Jewish guy, Reed Brower, owns six of the seven largest newspapers. Print's the seventh largest. So you're getting a uniform perspective. They go out of their way to crush any dissent, and that's how they want it. And they loathe the people that live there. They want to replace them, obviously. And it doesn't matter if they're Republican or Democrat. That's the thing. It's the convergent system. The whole system is rotten. The whole system is trying to destroy everyone that's here. So I use, again, Maine as an example, but I could have picked anywhere.
Yeah, one of the benefit of recent events is, I mean, the country wasn't going in a good direction anyway. And this great leap forward, if you will, by the oligarchs in COVID-19, and then the fomented riots and protest, and the struggle session, the cultural revolution that they're waging, is that it crystallizes it in the remaining, you know, the big, the 65% white majority in the country. And the issue becomes clearer. Although I still think a lot of normal people, normies, if you will, are loath to think of it in those terms, and they're trying to still see it in the terms of conventional politics, blaming liberals as if, you know, the activist liberals are the people at the top of the pyramid. No, they're proxies, or they're the shock troops. They're carrying out the destruction, but the destruction and chaos is there for a reason, because they want people to react to it. Good example is the whole defund the police thing. Destroy local police, create the mayhem, and then you create conditions for a militarized order. You know, despite the fact that the police had been allowed to do the job, they could have prevented martial law. You know, it's very easy to put down a riot if you want to, especially in cities like New York. But it's, you know, if you stand down and don't punish people, the rioters, it spreads, and then it kind of takes a life of its own, and it burns things out. It achieves a certain amount of property destruction, which I do think the various mayors and governors want a certain level of destruction, whether it's insurance, you know, get the insurance, destroy the businesses, because the big chain operations that are affected, they don't lose any money. They're insured. It's the small businesses that go away. And that goes back to that original idea, which just as an attempt, this is economic warfare to go after the middle class. And one way you go after the middle class in the United States is you destroy the remaining small local businesses that are, you know, somewhat independent. And I've mentioned this in past conversations with you and other people, is that also achieves a cultural agenda, because – It's through these corporations, which you alluded to earlier, is how you implement the global homo new normal agenda. It's small businesses that are resistant. I don't work for a corporation, so I have a much greater deal of autonomy and liberty to speak. If I worked for a big corporation, if I was a man of the system, I couldn't speak freely or as freely as I do, and I wouldn't, and people don't.
Yeah, you're at the mercy of their corporate policies and everything else, and you're totally at their mercy.
Yeah, and it's so the more a country becomes under that corporate, top down control, the more basically freedom of speech becomes meaningless. The First Amendment becomes meaningless, and then you don't need any explicit government laws banning free speech. The corporations do it for you. The same way that Google and YouTube and Facebook and Twitter impose censorship without ever having to go to the government, because they're a private corporation, despite the fact that they piggyback on platforms that were paid for by the taxpayer.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, Amazon, I think in 2018 or 19, they paid no corporate tax. Year prior, it was like 1% or something. I mean, it's really a joke. And then they invest that. They take that. It's like the hedge fund people, too. Same thing. And they try to legitimize their earnings through buying sports teams and all the rest of this stuff, the bread and circuses aspect. You look at the Boston Celtics. It's owned by a consortium that includes a bunch of people from Bain Capital. The New York Mets ownership groups, a bunch of Bernie Madoff co-conspirators. I mean, it's really ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And those are the same people, I've mentioned Yuri Bezmenov before, but the people who are quote unquote into sports are the people who are drinking beer and, getting loaded and eating junk food and stuff and watching these sports. And then the NFL, for example, turns around and pledges to spend $500 million on quote social justice causes at the behest of the players. Yeah, right. Like it's the behest of the players. Considering that I think it's like 10, I think it's 10 of 32 NFL owners are Jewish. And so anyway, but like, you see all this stuff and I mean, how could you not, you and I had met, I can't remember if we had started recording it or not, but the idea that everything was interconnected, like, of course it is. And that's, it's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing. And let me start with the negative. It's a bad thing in the sense that it's a systemic threat. It's a good thing in the sense that it's unsalvageable and it's pretty easy. The solution, sweep the whole thing away. It's rotten. Demolish it. Build something else.
Yeah, I mean, look at something like NASCAR, where the origins of NASCAR was sort of, I guess it was the South, and it was running, getting cars fast enough to escape from G-Men, and then immediately it's corporatized and it's taken over, and they're trying to globalize its appeal. They have to introduce global homo and have to make it woke, and so they introduce this guy Bubba, who then proceeds to fake a hate crime. Then all of a sudden you can't have rebel flags at a NASCAR event. It's in the South, but that's not even tolerated at all. Cause again, the cultural distinction of the South has to be laid flat and destroyed. And this starts, if you allow the iconoclasm and sort of the cultural beheading of the South, it's not too long before it spreads north. And we saw that this year, with not only Thomas Jefferson and Robert E. Lee but you have, Abraham Lincoln and U.S. Grant and even Albert Pike, of all people, statues being torn down. And yeah. Now it's become, Mount Rushmore now is being questioned, this piece of artwork. But, knowing what I know about history, there's a lot of contradiction in American history. One thing is Mount Rushmore. That's a sort of like a symbol of the contradiction of the American Republic. Because, if you look at it philosophically, Lincoln and Roosevelt are far different than Washington and Jefferson, at least rhetorically. But we're supposed to celebrate it. But nevertheless, now it's become almost, was it that senator from Delaware, was it Duckworth or what's her name?
Forget. Oh yeah, Tammy Duckworth.
Duckworth, who's? Let's talk about Mount Rushmore and George Washington and all that. I think it was Matt Taibbi who said this is going to end with Wolf Blitzer wearing a tashiki and taking a detonator to Mount Rushmore. That's where this ends, you know. And this is this mad rush, this liberal thing. It's just because there's no, they don't see any limits or objectives. It's just like, it's almost like for the moment thrill. This is the weakness of the liberal activists, the leftist activists. Yeah. But ultimately, I do think it's the destruction of you know, heritage America, so you can create this globalist vision, you know, that they have, that the World Economic Forum has, and the Great Reset that they're talking about. And they openly talk about a great economic reset. And how are you going to do that with sovereign governments and legacy systems? Well, they've talked about doing away with legacy systems. And lo and behold, the COVID-19 crisis gives them a pretext, because now we can't walk in to brick and mortar stores and do regular commerce, intercourse with people. You can't shake hands. People are wearing masks. Everything's being done online. Funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. You know, World Economic Forum actually comes up quite a bit in the way life should be, mm-hmm. ? You know, that's, they call it globalization 4.0. You know, it's like this pre-outlined plan that they have, and you're absolutely right. This is any kind of, you know, in the earlier part of the 20th century, it was traditional empires that were an impediment to this globalism. So they engineered a way to destroy all of the traditional empires of Europe. And then, so they used nationalism as a wedge there as far as the post-colonial stuff. And then after that, once you've got a nascent idea of nationalism, now most of these post-colonial states were built to fail because they incorporate multiple ethnicities and tribes and things like that. You know, think about Nigeria with four major tribes and who knows how many other ones, with religious differences and stuff as well. But that was by design, obviously. And then you undermine the nationalism as the next step. And that's really what we're seeing now. And I mean, this has been going on for a long time with the European Union and, you know, a lot of these other things and the multiple free trade agreements and everything else. And it's really all the stuff Donald Trump hit on when he was talking about, you know, getting out of this stuff, the TPP and NAFTA and NATO, which is just totally basically exists to just bomb non-compliant regimes into oblivion. I mean, it's like you look at what happened with Yugoslavia. One of the first things they did after they threw Slobodan Milosevic in a cell in The Hague was have a pride parade in Belgrade. It's like, come on, you know, it's so obvious.
You see the same thing in Ukraine too. Yeah, they're trying to promote the homosexual agenda.
Oh, they're all over the Ukraine. Yeah, I actually, so I've got a couple projects that are in the pipeline, actually. I just love writing. I'm writing all the time. And one of the things is I've been looking pretty closely at the Ukraine as a fault line. And you go and you look at, like, who's financing particular operations in the Ukraine. I believe it was, I may be wrong on the auspices. Actually, hold on one second. There's be some dead air for one quick second. Okay. While I look it up, because I don't want to get this wrong. But it's, it would be 2 seconds. Here we go. Okay. So the list of donors and or partners with the International Organization for Migration in the Ukraine include the World Health Organization, the European Union, the International Labor Organization, the Government of Canada, the Government of the Czech Republic, UNICEF, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, the Federal Office of Germany for Migration and Refugees, the Swiss Agency for Development and Cooperation, Swedish International Development Cooperation Agency, USAID, the US State Department, Government of the Quebec Province, UK Department for International Development, Norwegian Ministry of Foreign Affairs, MoneyGram, Western Union, Mobile Telesystems, MTS, Leo Burnett, and MTV.
MTV.
There you go. See, I mean, but you're right. So that's the Ukraine right there. I mean, those are the partnering or donating organizations to the International Organization for Migration, which is a sister organization with the UN, in the Ukraine. So,
and
yeah,
you see financial, cultural, entertainment sort of complex going in there, yep, to corrupt the morals of the Ukrainians, which, from what I understand, is fairly traditional still. It's, yeah.
It seems to be. So that's being regarded as a fault line, and they're trying to basically pry every country that they can loose from the Russian orbit, because it's not that it's not like the Putin regime doesn't have significant problems and stuff, but it's much closer to what responsible governance of a Western country, of any country for that matter, looks like. So they want to peel them off and incorporate them into this, you know, eventually this guy Vusterstaft or whatever, I can't pronounce his name, but he said basically he wants to create a European African economic union. So you basically have the Schengen area, but for Europe and Africa, which is abhorrent to say the least to think about. And his justification was, well, the GDP would rival that of China. Thanks, guy.
So if you thought Greece was incompatible with the European Union, wait till you have Ghana.
Right. Oh, that should be a blast, you know. Or
same currency.
It's insane. I mean, it's not insane, actually. It's homicidal malevolence and greed.
Yeah, well, it's that they're trying to build a Tower of Babel, and you know they won't succeed, but they'll create a lot of mayhem and destruction in the process of attempting to do this. So it exposes the complex and high level malevolence of these organizations, and how, you know, ordinarily people don't think the World Health Organization, you know, the general public doesn't think the World Health Organization or the World Bank or IMF or even the Western Union or, you know, the government of Canada as being malevolent. But obviously these institutions have been taken over to pursue these objectives, which is the destruction of these local cultures or governments, and in the process create a lot of disruption in people's lives, which we've seen in Libya and Syria. And it's amazing to me that Americans don't look at what's happening right now in the United States and go, maybe it's our turn now.
It blows my mind that people don't, I mean, but they don't really understand. Most Americans really have no idea what went on today, even today, in Libya, and why that's a problem.
Yeah, they now have slavery in Libya, by the way, now, so because of Barack Obama's policies.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, if you, by the way, let me see if I can find this real quick. Yes, the World Health Organization. So as I mentioned, I've been working on a lot of future writing projects. So the World Health Organization, this just popped up as well. But if the listeners are curious why the World Health Organization seems so susceptible to naked partisanship, it's because it is part of the globalist matrix and it receives funding from organizations such as the IOM, which I just mentioned in connection with the Ukraine, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Bloomberg Family Foundation, the European Commission, the World Bank, the Rockefeller Foundation, and the Open Society Institute Budapest.
Mm-hmm.
So there you go.
And I guess George Soros is Hungarian. He's a Hungarian Jew.
Yep.
Where does he? Do you know where he resides?
I want to say New York, but
yeah, he lives in the United States.
That's just my default is to just say every Jew lives in New York. I know that sounds bad, but I know he briefly was in the UK. I'm 99% positive he's in the US, but. As far as where exactly?
So does he share an underground base with Bill Gates or something under a volcano or something?
I wouldn't even be surprised.
I said he's close to 90, so I don't know how relevant he is as a person. It's the network and the sort of the globalist bankers that he represents. He's a Rothschild agent.
Yeah, and his son, Alexander Soros, and then I think there's Colum Bell Soros. I forget what her first name is, but she's another one. Andrea Soros Colum Bell. She is one of his, a child from his first marriage. And then he had a second marriage with Alexander Soros. So those are the two names, his progeny, that I've seen most commonly linked to this stuff. So they'll carry on the legacy.
Well, one thing that you do bring up in that, that part about the Ukraine is the function of these NGOs and foundations. And recently I did a show discussing perhaps the necessity assuming that there was the political will to do this. But back in the 1950s, there was a Reese Committee hearings on the Great Foundations and their role in subversion. At the time, they were targeting communism because that was just what was the fear. It was Age of McCarthy and these things that was going on. But what they investigated, the role of foundations in supporting un-American activities, supporting, undermining the American system of government. By that, they mean unlawful or ways of subverting the government outside constitutional practices. That's how they defined it or something like that. But what they exposed was how these foundations were being used, using their tax-exempt status to use the resources that were bestowed upon them by these wealthy capitalist families to engage in un-American activities. Now, in the 1950s, you had enough cohesion in the country to that term wasn't necessarily controversial. Now we wouldn't even know what that means anymore. So there isn't the cohesion or a uniformity or just the culture to back that up. But it's just as a mental exercise. I thought if we had a similar investigation now of the various foundations, even corporations, and their funding of groups like Black Lives Matter, Antifa, the funding of George Soros to finance the campaigns of these various DAs, and maybe how they're acting against the interest of the public. They're actually agents of foreign interest, even governors. And if there was the political will to engage, have some sort of congressional inquiry into this, because what we're seeing now, I think, is a form of a color revolution occurring in the United States. And if you're familiar how this, you know, the Gene Sharp method, and even the, you know, last May and June, we were hearing reports about pallets of bricks being delivered to cities, and that occurred in Egypt during their color revolution. And that was, of course, that was funded by intelligence agencies, the CIA, and you had flash mobs of the same thing. This was all using social media. Similar thing occurring now with Black Lives Matter. But the idea that they have an investigation, not only of the recent riots and turmoil that's being stoked, being funded by, I mean, it's openly funded by like Coca-Cola. So you have these corporations that are brag about lavishing hundreds of millions of dollars of Black Lives Matter, which isn't, you know, is engaged in a lot of rioting and illegal activity that you could investigate it and then go after these corporations for funding for promoting, you know, riotous behavior to destabilize the government. But you even go further back, you can also investigate this, assuming that there was a recognition of the COVID-19 pandemic as being an operation, or at least a suspicion. There's enough evidence to suggest this was an operation, because you had, what, in October 2001, the Event 201, there was an operation being done in conjunction with the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Johns Hopkins University, World Health Organization, and how they kind of tabletop this exercise. And lo and behold, 2 or 3 months later, we have this pandemic. Again, the effect of which, or at least the intensity of which, is grossly exaggerated by institutions that are tied to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. I'm thinking the Imperial College of London, Ferguson's computer modeling, which has been exposed to being completely fraudulent. This produced this reports that predicted 500,000 dead in the UK, 2 million dead in the United States. This justified the economic lockdown. At the same time, also the $6 trillion bailout of Wall Street and the imposed austerity that is necessary to cover up that bailout. And you can also, people have done the research, is that the various institutions that advise the various states to impose the lockdown also have ties to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. My point being here is that you could establish a network, a conspiracy, if you will, to do this, to pull this off. And I would like to, it would be nice if there was a full-on investigation, because this does constitute a crime against the public. Something on the line, just a recognition that you have NGOs, foundations, corporations engaging in covert warfare, fourth generation warfare against the American people, waging economic warfare. Because then on the other side of this, you have the World Economic Forum openly saying that the COVID-19 pandemic, the crisis, represents a unique opportunity to impose the Great Reset, economic reset, which will do away with our currency, do away with legacy systems like small businesses and personally owned vehicles and brick and mortar operations. They're planning a massive economic reset, which will not improve the living standards of the typical American, not just the typical human being on planet Earth, but will impose a global austerity to reset things. And they're talking about this openly. It's almost like it's an open conspiracy.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it's, and then of course, you know, as with any good gaslighting operation, you say that and they're like, well, what do you mean? That's the, of course that's not happening.
Yes, I mean, it's like, you know, I asked someone, is it really just a coincidence that they tabletop this thing in October 2019 and it happens in January 2020? I mean, okay, are you a coincidence theorist?
Yeah, that's it. That's interesting. I was not aware of the timing. I know that they have been saying that, but yeah, that's,
well, there was a here's another thing. There was a Whitney. You familiar with Whitney Webb?
Yes. Yes.
She writes for the, I think, Last American Vagabond.
Yep.
And she wrote an article. I guess, you know, it could be about techno-tyranny, how the U.S. national security state is using coronavirus to fulfill an Orwellian vision. This was published a couple months ago, but this was unearthed in a FOIA request by the Electronic Privacy Information Center. Apparently, the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. I didn't know that existed, but it does exist. I think it was created in the Defense Authorization Act of 2012 or something, however. But it produced a white paper report predicting a fourth industrial revolution, an artificial intelligence economy that could compete with China. This is part of the credit, you know, the social credit system that China has. And they're trying to emulate it, and they're trying to improve it, have it basically be more extensive than China's. And it called for the doing away with legacy systems. And what they call legacy systems is basically the economic system we're familiar with businesses, brick and mortar, person and vehicles, you know, these things. These are all legacy systems that have to be done away with. But it called for all these measures. This was back in like 2017, 2018. Well, lo and behold, COVID-19 hits, and this becomes a pretext to impose this new system. Because with the virus apparently killing millions of Americans, right? Oh, wait, didn't do that. we have to have this, and this is the new normal. And all of a sudden, flattening the curve within a few weeks became, we can't emerge till we have the new normal. Bill Gates talks about this. The governor up in Maine talked about this. Says, wait, I thought this was about just flattening the curve and taking stress off the medical system. It wasn't about reimagining the world. And all of a sudden, we're being told we can't emerge from our house arrest until we accept the new normal, which is, you know, full-on AI, 24/7 surveillance, contact tracing, forced vaccinations, digital ID tattoos. You know, Bill Gates proposes this. And a few years ago, if I were to tell you that they're going to tattoo everybody, they'd call me a conspiracy nut. But now he's openly proposing this as a measure to allow us to engage in some form of commerce.
It's truly dystopian, and it's incredible how fast it's happened. I mean, I was certainly, I'm not surprised by any of it, and certainly we predicted this, but the idea like that this stuff was coming for sure, but how quickly and how brazenly they're doing it is a little bit shocking. Although I can't help, I've always kind of quietly wondered the last couple of years why, this is obviously not condoning this, but why they haven't just come out and done it, you know? And this is before I had a full understanding of the neoliberal system, right? Because it has to have this pretense of legitimacy of the whole kabuki theater with the elections and everything else. Mm-hmm. So there needs to be some catalyzing event that precipitates them doing this. So they can't just do it, because then people will be up in arms. They have to have some kind of pretext. So if it's COVID, or I'm sure there would have been something else if not this, that's what will create this quote new normal. And then you see people, you know, the population is so indoctrinated that they'll just hammer people for not complying with these measures that really have nothing to do with anything in a lot of cases, again, and it just ties into that social function of the struggle sessions, of just smashing people because they're not complying. And, you know, it's you know, it's alluded to in Fahrenheit 451. John Stuart Mill writes about it. I mean, there's this kind of tyranny of the mob. Go all the way back to Polybius. I mean, the tyranny of the mob, and that's the whole anarcho-tyranny system. So you've got the mob working hand in glove, unwittingly, in most cases anyway, with the establishment, and thinking that they're rebelling against, who knows what they think they're rebelling against. In fact, they're not really thinking, right? And it's like, because the mob's not a rational entity. And it's like you were saying earlier, it's just the thrill of just destroying something that, because they can. It's sort of like a weird kind of a power trip. It's a diffusion of responsibility. And it's the just the craven desire to drag everything down to this lower level. And that's what egalitarianism gets you, because you can't equalize up.
Yeah, the I see this again holistically as economic warfare to impose a new order out of order. I mean, out of chaos, a new order. The pandemic, the riots, then phase two of the pandemic is there to keep the economy under pressure, shut down, while they run up the debt. This eventually destroys the currency, and you have a currency collapse, and they can impose, guaranteed income. That's what all this relief checks get you acclimated to, getting a universal basic income system. It's a credit system. You'll have a credit system that you can buy with. That can be taken away like that because it's electronic, and it's almost like the Claret-Piven plan, where you just run the debt up, just bankrupt the system, to usher in total socialism or oligarchic collectivism. That's what Norman Dodd, the investigator for the Reese Committee that I mentioned, said. Ultimately, the end game was oligarchic collectivism, and we're seeing that today. Brandon Smith has a website, and he wrote an article called Globalists Reveal that the Great Economic Reset is coming in 2021. And this is a theme of the World Economic Forum in 2021. And again, it matters because it's just the fact that you have a group of people who deign to have the authority to set the global economic trends for the world, just because they can afford to fly to Switzerland every year and meet. But when you get a group of billionaires together with politicians that talk about what they're going to do the economy for the, you know, for in the near future, they're presuming to do a lot of things. One thing would be, if you're going to reset, or if you're going to change, you're going to shift global trade or imbalances, you're going to have to engage in a lot of things like civil wars and destabilization, because that's how you are able to manipulate migration. That's how you shift industry, the geographics of industry, of production. They talk in these terms and these grand visions. And so the little guy and his plans, his small business, or how much he plans to save, or whether or not he has enough money to buy a new car or send his kid to college, they don't count for anything with these people. So they'll just be brushed aside. Brandon Smith wrote in this article, he goes, many alternative economists have often wrongly attributed the Fed's habit of making things worse to hubris and ignorance. They think the Fed actually wants to save the financial system or protect the golden goose, but that is not a reality. The truth is, the Fed is not a bumbling maintenance man. The Fed is a saboteur, a suicide bomber that is willing to destroy even itself as an institution in order to explode the U.S. economy and clear the path for a new globally centralized one-world system, hence global reset. In 2015, in my article, The Global Economic Reset Has Begun, I stated, the global reset is not a response to a process of collapse we are trapped in today. No, the global reset, as implemented by central banks and the BIS IMF, is the cause of the collapse. The collapse is a tool, a flamethrower, burning a great hole in the forest to make way for the foundations of the globalist ziggurat to be built. Economic disaster serves the interest of elitists. Now, in 2020, we see the globalist plan coming to fruition, with the elites revealing what appears to be their intent to launch their reset in 2021. The World Economic Forum officially announced the Great Reset Initiative as part of their covert action platform last week, and a summit is scheduled in January 2021 to discuss their plans more openly with the world and the mainstream media. The World Economic Forum also posted a rather bizarre video on the reset, which consists of a series of images of the world falling apart and images of factories releasing harmless carbon emissions into the air, which I suppose is meant to scare us with the notions of global warming. The destruction is then reset as the at a push of a button, with everything reversing back to a pristine humanless world of nature and the world and the words join us. The reset, according to discussions by the IMF, is basically the next stage in the formation of a one-world economic system, potential global government. This seems to fall in line with the solutions offered during the Event 201 pandemic simulation and the simulation of a coronavirus pandemic that was held by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the World Economic Forum, only 2 months before the real thing happened at the beginning of 2020. Event 201 suggested that one of the top solutions to a pandemic would be institutions of a centralized global economic body that could handle the financial response to the coronavirus. Is it not convenient that the events of the real coronavirus pandemic fall exactly in line with the Event 201 simulation, as well as directly in line with the global reset plans of the IMF and the World Economic Forum? As they say, let no crisis go to waste, or as in the motto of the globalists, order out of chaos.
That's harrowing. I did not really. I mean, I've been kind of heading down that path as far as, you know, awareness to this kind of thing, but I did not realize, you know, it was quite at that level.
He goes on to say that the reason why you're seeing the turmoil and the chaos is they want to collapse society, collapse the economic system so much that people are begging for a new order. And so they can't really impose this unless people voluntarily in their own minds ask for it. And so, yeah, you may think it's voluntary because you're not recognizing that the chaos that you're living in was created. It's problem, reaction, solution, that old formula.
Yeah, exactly. It kind of goes, I referenced Bezmenov earlier. It's the same thing. It's like foment chaos, you know, and then eventually they rely the new normal, normalize. Mm-hmm. So, it absolutely makes sense. You know, it goes to these people. Yeah, they'll go fly their private jets into Davos and basically hash out the finer details. But yeah, it's unsurprising. And that illusion of a say so in the system is essential to it, because like you said, then people are basically asking for this. They're asking to have it imposed upon them because the order is, well, it ostensibly solves the chaos. But as you mentioned, and you know, as I've mentioned myself before, yeah, they're the ones stoking all of this chaos. They're using this indoctrinated population, all these imported hostile aliens, to try and create unrest and get us to that year zero, where it's a blank slate. You know, it's like Carlson says, it's a land with some GDP attached to it. And the old metrics, you know, in this hybridized system that they're pushing towards, I mean, we won't know 100% what it looks like, but it will be pretty much nothing will be outside of the purview of the quote unquote elites, and everything will be of a transactionary nature. And that's harrowing, obviously, because the intent is to have you totally compliant or you can't survive.
That's why you can't have remaining local patriotisms or different cultures. That's why you don't want old statues standing, because you don't want those old reference points. And of course, the education system has gone a long way in facilitating this, because if you look at the another thing that should be investigated, of course, is what's been going on in college campuses for the past few decades. They're not only is it a you know, predatory lending degree mill, it's also they produce social justice warriors, or, you know, red guards, if you will, like sausages. They spit them out, and it's the curriculum and the education system. They've been doing this. There's actually social justice warrior classes in many universities, and the funding of the universities, the system funds itself. They're endowed to do this. And they're producing, you know, students that have no historical context or understanding or appreciation of classical literature. It's not being taught anymore, you know. And again, if you're not reasonably well versed in these things, if you're not familiar with Huck Finn or Shakespeare, you're you're very easily aroused to becoming one of the social, you know, these green-haired or pink-haired social justice warriors, because you have no culture reference points. You're deracinated. You have no, you know, nothing to really to refer to or to look back upon. And so you go to college, you get a new identity, and you're off for the races, because you have no job anyway, because the economy's been hollowed out and you're in debt.
You know, right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Go work for some nonprofit, maybe, or get your UBI.
Yeah, and you're taught to hate whitey, even if you're white, as opposed to the banker who may belong to a certain tribe who's put you in debt.
Right. Right. Exactly. And it's scary how easily manipulated these people are. I mean, they'll scream stuff, well, it's because of your privilege or whatever. And it really is this original sin. I mean, it's striking to me how this idea of, quote, privilege, like 2 years ago, it was kind of a fringe thing. I mean, how quickly it's been able to metastasize. And it's literally something someone just made up. And it's become, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, it's been created, like most of this stuff, out of whole cloth. And mm-hmm. then it's like idea laundering. And then you have the academies pushing it. It's like, well, this person references Judith Butler. It's like, well, Judith Butler just made something up too. So it's not like using a theory to reference a theory that references something else someone just made up is not scholarship. Mm-hmm. But if you have no ability to think critically, then you're like, oh yeah, Judith Butler. Okay, cool. Well, what is her justification for gender being a social construct? What's the evidence for that? Because there's plenty of biological evidence that contradicts. First of all, what is gender, right? Like, it's this total, gender is a construct. If you want to talk about constructs, gender is the construct. Mm-hmm. You have sexual dimorphism, and you have people who kind of are more masculine or feminine, as we might understand it, along those lines. And they're the odd kind of intersex or hermaphrodite people, whatever the term is. And that's it. Okay. And that's it. And that, and this stuff though, is problematic, you know, because of intersex people. It's like, okay, well, that doesn't undermine the fact that, for example, you have like the fact that black Africans are born with blonde hair. Like, does that undermine the notion of race? No. I mean, but it's treated that way. Like, well, mm-hmm. you know, it's because they're malnourished. That's what happens. They don't have the pigmentation. Most of those people have pigment. It's either dyed or it's because they're malnourished. That's what it is. So, I mean, you know, they use these concepts that are created out of nothing. And if you're, as you mentioned, you're deracinated, you have no frame of reference with which to resist this stuff. You have no critical thinking skills. So you can't look critically at what you're receiving and going like, well, this is just something someone made up. There's no legitimacy to this. There's no evidence provided. The evidence is other stuff that someone just made up. And it sounds good because it's all written in jargon. I mean, they teach you how to write in academic jargon, so it's basically incomprehensible. Most of it's just circular reasoning. I mean, they already have accepted the premise as true, and then they try to justify it. They work backwards. I mean, that's not how – it's the complete opposite of everything that for 2,000 years Westerners have been – you know, doing the opposite of, you know, working through things like the Socratic methods, Socratic inquiry, and asking the questions to get to the conclusion rather than work. I mean, you can work backwards, obviously, deductive and inductive reasoning, you know, whatever. But like the idea is the circular reasoning, you've already taken it as axiomatic that there's 6,000 genders. And then we're going to go ahead and use Judith Butler, who's already accepted this as true, as our proof that it's true. Well, that's not how it works. But as you mentioned, it's like they just grind these people. And also, the more people who are able to go into university who don't belong in university has a lot to do with it too. So if maybe 15% of the population has the mental faculties to be subjected to an actual rigorous Western curriculum, if around half of the millennial and Zoomer population are going to college, that helps with their Ponzi scheme of lending, but it also has a lot of people who really don't have the intellect to be there in the first place, and they're easily programmed. They just get more adult daycare, and then you churn them out screaming about white supremacy, and they have no idea of any of this stuff.
Yeah, and they're drilled with the idea of radical egalitarianism or equality, and of course, nature abhors that. It's completely unnatural. So when they're exposed to real inequality, which sometimes is justified, they think it's just, you know, it's something that you have to you know, protest against and destroy.
Yeah, exactly.
That's why, you know, they can't understand that there are a few that are excellent and then there are many who are mediocre. And that's where you get that sort of that Harris and Bergeron effect, where you start tearing everything down, destroying excellence because,
yeah,
you know, everyone needs to be equal. And expecting all groups to be equal despite, you know, radical cultural and physical differences. Even cultural, because they're just things independent society. Not all groups can be equal, especially, you know, in an America. Even if you got if you bought into that America is a nation of immigrants, and we can endlessly take in people without any problems from any area of the world, except, rather than thinking that maybe there's a certain phase where you can bring in people from a certain area and they'll function, whereas other people unlimited from a certain area won't work as well, and that a country should be able to make that distinction. But even if you bought into the, you know, America as a nation of immigrants, unlimited, is if you're going to have a constant flow of immigrants, you're always going to have inequality.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, because that's just the way it is. I mean, that's just something that the civil rights revolution was caught with, is when you did away with Jim Crow and segregation, and some of the impediments that Black Americans faced, particularly in the South, you're still stuck with inequality. And if you're going to have to wait perhaps many generations before, if you're going to maintain the same constitutional system, you know, neutral, laws and same laws, you're going to have to, there's going to be great inequality perhaps forever because groups are different. You're going to have, you're always going to have more Black jazz musicians than Chinese jazz musicians. Is that necessarily wrong? Same with athletics. You know, we accept the fact that there's inequality in athletics. In basketball, I think it's 85% Black. The NFL is like 75% Black. Major League Baseball, I think, I'm not sure the percent. It's more even there. But I'm saying is that these differences aren't necessarily a manifestation of injustice. It's just a reality.
Right. Yeah, exactly. And it's selective interpretation of what's unequal or unjust as well, because the 85% Black NBA is fine. But if you had, you probably have a 95% white league, the NHL, this is an issue. And you're constantly, oh, it needs more diversity. You mentioned NASCAR, same thing. So you get the mixed race Bubba Wallace, you know, going out and saying, oh God, I found a noose in my parking garage or whatever the case is, and now we have to dismantle the last vestiges of the Confederacy. And the sports thing is really insidious, because you see the obsession with Paul Kersey has written a lot about this, these kind of particularly in the South, actually, these people who have they've transferred the kind of feelings of nationalism and I guess solidarity that they would have, and that's goes to the alma mater. And then you have some 18-year-old kid who's like, well, I'm not going to go to Ole Miss because their mascot's a Confederate soldier or something. And it's like, they were obviously told that. They probably didn't know anything about it or care. Mm-hmm. Their handler probably told them that. And then the booster has to go, well, we need to have, you know, Daquan come and play shooting guard for us. So, you know, this can't stand. We're going to have to sacrifice our culture to get a couple wins. The basketball team, and you're seeing it with Mississippi, with the state of Mississippi on the flag, and you saw it with the college mascots and the professional mascots. I mean, I could care less about the whole Redskins thing. You know, the owner is his name. The owner echoes, let's say. So I could care less about him being targeted by this stuff. But you know, otherwise, yeah, like, you know, this is the kind of thing we're talking about, and it's, you know, it is. It's not sustainable. I mean, I think the linchpin to me is going to be what happens with technology, because if technology progresses to such a point where it becomes even more invasive than it is, they're still going to be able to continue to consolidate control, and it's going to be easy for them. But if it stalls out, or there's some way in which it can be brought under wraps, or there's some kind of I don't know. I don't even know, like, a, you know, there's some black swan, like solar flare, not even something like that, but it depends on where technology goes and how we manage it. And I think that that's going to be one of the key things. I mean, I'm always preaching, and I'm never going to stop preaching self-determination for all people, and every nation having their own self-determination. So if you have a responsible state, like I often, Hungary is a reference point. I published an article on Occidental Observer talking a little bit about Hungary and Poland, and a lot of these countries are not as, quote, based as people think they are. They bring in a lot of guest workers from Philippines and Southeast Asia and stuff, Mongolia. So they're making the same, they're doing the same thing every other Western country's done. You know, oh, well, we're against, well, we're going to bring in guest workers. They're not guest workers. They stay, obviously. But if you have a responsible state managing these things, and you have an economic reorientation towards something that's more autarkic, that kind of thing. I mean, that's what, that's really the crux of the show, The Way Life Should Be, that I'm doing, the new podcast I'm launching, is in line with what Tom's saying with all of Free Atlantic Radio, where we're preaching an Atlantic homeland for New Englanders, possibly upstate New York, like Canadian Maritimes, because there is a sense of a geographic region. There's a sense of an ethnic solidarity and purpose. And there would be strict controls on this kinds of stuff. I mean, ideally, there's a lot of work to be done. But this stuff has to be brought under control, because the more... it's destructive for a lot of reasons. We can even see everything from, you know, attention spans to, you know, thousands and thousands of reasons. But if the globalist establishment is going to continue to expand its control and get more entrenched in the hegemony, or we should say retrenched, right, if they're planning on this reset, then the key is going to be how this technology is managed, because things will increasingly become digitized and online. But the more divorced things become from reality, the more untenable they also become, because, as I mentioned, like with the whole system itself, it's at odds with natural law, and it's at odds with merit and these kinds of things. Things can and will go wrong, and increasingly so, even if the technology continues to improve and become more pervasive and invasive. So, you know, I mean, that's one good thing, I guess. I'm always trying to find the positive in things.
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing that they, you know, it's, oh, what's that line? Bliss it was that dawn to be alive, but to be young was very heaven. That was William Wordsworth, I think, commenting on the French Revolution, sort of this idea that the world was changing and you know, we're given an opportunity to be a part of this. Of course, it didn't turn out. French Revolution didn't turn out to be the best event, and in fact, some would say it's still going on. but the idea that we're given an opportunity, and I'm not so young anymore, but I'm healthy enough to take part in it. That we're, again, you've kind of alluded to it earlier, is that they've given us an opportunity here with their reach. It might be an overreach, a great leap forward, a bridge too far at this point for them. And they could have just let things continue the way they were. For some reason, they needed to accelerate it. And in that acceleration, it's gotten so obvious. It's like David Icke said. He said something on that interview he did. He said that the globalist cabal have walked into the room and exposed themselves, revealed themselves to everybody, and the doors clicked behind them. Now what are you going to do? And it's increasingly, it's become very difficult for people to ignore it, because the wolf is at the door now. So what are you going to do? I'm surprised by how many people are still blissfully ignoring it, thinking, you know, that somehow things are going to get normal. They're going to let people take their masks off. It's getting weirder and creepier, and that's for a specific purpose. It's a psychological warfare. But it's given us an opportunity to, I think, get more people's attention. And otherwise, I don't think we wouldn't have gotten anyone's attention, you know, outside the few people that, you know, that catch on or listen. The internet might have been, you know, I mean, like, good example was the internet. I don't think the internet was created to liberate people. It had that effect for several decades. Now they're trying to rein it back in, but it got out of control for them. And I don't think they really fully anticipated. It got everyone online, and now we're all monitored. Like, this conversation is probably being taken up somewhere and recorded, you know.
Oh, yeah. No, I text, you know, it's funny because it's like, yeah. We were talking about when I was, we were working on the biography. My biography for The God That Failed, because Black House has biographies for everybody, all the authors. I don't think they have one for me, but I made one up. But it was funny because they were like, well, the publisher was like, well, why even bother? You know, the State Department's probably monitoring all your emails anyway. And I laughed and I'm like, well, I'm going to try to keep my job for at least another 6 months. So,
well, I think it keeps low level people from doxing you and harassing you.
Cause, right.
You know, from a practical matter, you have to worry about that. Yeah.
Right. But the higher ups, they could come and shoot me in the head if they wanted to any second.
Yeah. And just at that point, it's just safety in numbers. You know, if they're going to do that, then they're going to do it. I'm sorry.
There's no, I mean, you might be able to take one out. This is all theoretical, of course.
Yeah.
But,
but it's an opportunity. And again, more people have awoken to, what's really going on because of what they've done in the past, you know, 5 months, you know, that otherwise would have been the case.
Absolutely. And they have shown their hand much more, and so they are going all in on this. So if it fails, the reprisals will be swift and severe. And we, like you quoted David Icke, I mean, we now know who they are. The architects have revealed themselves. Why they've done it so prematurely? Why they are they high in their own supply? Are they that assured in their own minds of? I mean, they are, many of them, sociopathic or narcissistic. So I mean, certainly there's a lot of that. You know, you kind of run into this whole thing. It's like with a lot of the double talking from the Jewish interest groups, right? Like you know, the fellow white thing, or like trying to be too clever. You know, you see these lectures online of like, oh, Emanuel Seller, this Jewish figure who was so instrumental in the passage of the immigration that brought people of color to America in huge numbers. Well, it's not a Jewish thing. You know, it didn't come from the Jews. It wasn't driven by the Jews. It's like, you know, claiming one thing and then another. And yeah, part of that's gaslighting, but part of it also is just this kind of like getting the narcissist, the need to have someone recognize the genius of the thing. And so showing the hand before it's done, like if they were truly... if we weren't dealing with a bunch of narcissists, there would not be this need to preen before the camera and kind of show off how smart they are ahead of time. There would not be this need to telegraph the moves. And it's like daring you. It's like, you know, I'll use a sports metaphor, but it's like, you know, you basically telegraph a player. You say like, we're going to run this play, or we're going to do this. Now try and stop us.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like trying to show we're that superior to you, that we can assert our will on you even though you know what's coming. And that you're right, there are too many people who sort of blissfully think, oh, it's the libs and, you know, some temporary insanity. It's no. It's they're just gearing up for the end game, and it's on us to ensure that they are not successful. And we've got to fight tooth and nail to make sure that they're not successful, because it's going to be unimaginably bad for us. The population they're trying to engineer won't know any better. They won't know any better. Most of them don't currently know any better. They're okay with getting $1,200 a month and buying sneakers and screaming about white supremacy. Mm-hmm. But for people who want to really live, this needs to be resisted with everything we've got.
Yeah, they're being bribed into their own poverty. It's like they're being.
Yeah.
Take this little bit of money here and don't work. And, you know, keep watching Netflix for a little while you have it.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I had a conversation just over the weekend, you know, with a family member and, you know, an older sibling who's, in many ways, a typical right wing baby boomer. And again, it's just to him, it's just liberals and stupidity. And I kind of trying to mark out, this isn't stupidity. I mean, it's obvious that the collateral damage from the lockdown was going to be horrendous, far worse than anything that the pandemic would kill. And so, and they know this. So it's not stupidity. It's this intentional destruction that you're doing. But there's such resistance to this that, you can stake out the connections of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and these organizations and just this chronology of events and their connections what they have to gain from it and the conflict of interest. But still it's to them, it's just a coincidence. It doesn't mean anything. This is politics. And, we have to vote Republican, you know,
you're right. Exactly. We got to get the Dems out of power.
Yeah.
Even though they're, I mean, they've got the White House, right? And
yeah,
the House maybe. No, I mean they don't have the House. Sorry. The Republicans have the White House.
The White House and the Senate. Dems have the House. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, Mitch McConnell's walking around with a mask on, right? So and the revolution has occurred that they shut the churches down. They essentially have them shut down still in most places because of restrictions. And no one's rebelling against that. The Supreme Court said that shutting down the churches was not a violation of the First Amendment.
Interestingly enough, some of the most significant pushback I saw was, and this is my tribe here, the meatheads, with the gyms being shut down. There was a lot of pushback. Gyms finding ways around it, gyms defying and saying, we're opening anyway, screw you. Because that health and well-being is so, that physical aspect, it's not, and I joke about the meathead thing, but that is so, has so many positive benefits for your psychological well-being. And you take that away from someone, that the bottom can drop out. And we saw that with a lot of people. And so it's like, it's not a joke. It's not a hobby for a lot of people. It's a source of balance, being physically active. And it was cool, though, to see people responding by running outside and doing a lot more outdoor activities. But then, of course, they respond. What do? Try to close the national parks and stuff.
Yes.
Like, well, you can't go see the nature that are, screw you. You know, like, it's ours. It's ours. We pay for it. It's, if it's ostensibly our country, which it's not, but if, at least in practice, but it is ours, so we should be able to go and use it, and we know the risks and we will undertake them if we need to. If it was a really serious, now there could be long-term health effects from this thing. I've heard things about possible sterility, diminished lung capacity, like there could be some long-term effects. And, so I'm not diminishing that or minimizing, there's a lot of people who die from it that have kind of weird, a lot of other stuff going on. And, there's a lot, it's obviously the lethality of it is nowhere near what was initially projected, as we've talked quite a bit about already.
The model himself didn't seem too frightened of it. He's the one who was caught visiting having his married girlfriend visit Neil Ferguson. I mean, right. Obviously too afraid of the, I don't think he kept gloves on the whole time or mask on the whole time when he's with her.
Well, the thing is, like, if you're genuinely trying to stop a pandemic, you don't do this stuff piecemeal. You just do it. You do it decisively. Yeah. You lock it down. You don't start oscillating and then having Fauci on CNN saying, oh, well, if you want to have sex with anonymous gay sex with anonymous strangers, that's fine. But, handshaking is out. It's like, this isn't the stuff you see. You see unified, serious action. And they're either, from the Trump administration, it's, Trump himself is obviously just incompetence, but at least from my perspective, but as far as the people surrounding him, this is not the case. And the establishment itself, of course, that they're kind of tied into this one major faction of the establishment. This is done intentionally, because if there were serious measures that needed to be taken, we see from their behavior. Step back a little bit. Sorry. I've kind of got away from what I was trying to say. What we would see is from their actions, or what we do see from their actions, are what the seriousness or lack thereof is. Mm-hmm. So from observing their behavior, we know if they're engaged in certain self-preservation methods, how serious it is. And again, it has some severity for people. There are potentially side effects that may manifest themselves that we don't know about. But as far as using this thing as pretext to consolidate and then detonate and consolidate, it works very well. And we see the fact that, they're going out and encouraging protests and things like that. It's a fundamental unseriousness of the pandemic, quote unquote, because it's not going to, they're not going to do that if it's something like, I don't know if you ever read The Stand. If it's Captain Trips, they're not telling you to go out and protest because 99% of the people are going to die.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're going to be taking steps to make sure that their butts are covered and they're going to be away from this stuff. And you just don't see that. And so it's kind of
funny because people, to the extent that people are familiar with pandemics, it's Hollywood, right? It's Contagion. Yeah. It's The Stand, the miniseries or the book, which is kind of, it was made into a miniseries. But their idea is, that, of course, our idea of it is always the government trying to cover up the seriousness of it, underestimating or at least misrepresenting the lethality of it to maintain public order. Actually, it's the opposite. It's the government exaggerating it.
Right.
So it's a, you know, it's like actually they wildly exaggerate to justify the lockdown for the austerity, because you've got a global economic depression and no one's blaming the banks. No one's blaming the politicians that created the debt bubble. They deflated the bubble and they're blaming a damn virus.
Exactly. Yeah. You know? And it, like I said, again, you would see these people through their actions would telegraph if there is much more, and I'm talking in terms of just purely in lethality, you would see them going for Martha's Vineyard or whatever and locking it down and being like, okay, bye, you know, because they have the means to do so, and they're not doing it, and it's not being treated with any seriousness through their actions. It's just the rhetoric.
For how long did they talk about masks and none of them were wearing masks? And then they started doing it in May.
Yeah, exactly.
It was all theatrics, and it got ridiculous. Then there's no standard mask. Nancy Pelosi, it's a stylish silk scarf.
Yeah, and I've mentioned this before, and then they're continuing to resettle thousands of so-called refugees into the country.
Yes.
While everyone else is locking down. I mean, that's either I've said this before, so let's say it is a pandemic. Let's take it at face value. That still telegraphs their homicidal intent, because they're taking disease vectors from coronavirus-stricken areas and settling them in your town.
Well, here's the thing. I was watching – this is the theatrics. I was watching the Surgeon General. I think it was on Face the Nation, and they're talking about masks. He completely contradicted himself. And back in late February, March, he said, don't wear masks. And he gave this reason why, and it all made sense. Now he's saying wear masks. And if you have it, my question, if you have an expert and he contradicts himself without justifying the contradiction, is he still an expert?
Right.
He's a fool. He can't be trusted. And the same thing goes for Fauci. Fauci contradicted himself on the in particular the mask issue. He also contradicted himself when he said on Face the Nation that there could be 200,000 to 400,000 Americans dying from this thing, but then the New England Journal of Medicine said it's no more deadly than the typical flu. And he was never asked to justify that contradiction. So this is what the public is faced with, to the extent that they know. But this stuff isn't talked about in the mainstream press or the New York Times. And but I was watching. Yeah, the Surgeon General was on Face the Nation. Of course, the news babe interviewing him wasn't wearing a mask, because she's in a studio by herself. He's in a studio, and he's wearing a mask during the interview, just for theatrics.
It's just, yeah, it's completely asinine. I mean, honestly.
I mean, it's like, and, you know, his voice is kind of muffled because of it. But, you know, you can take the mask off, buddy, if you're in a room by yourself. Of course, it doesn't work because people have said that the mask doesn't really protect you from anything. It's like expecting a chain link fence to keep mosquitoes out of your yard. And plus the fact how people wear it. There's no standard for it. People are going to be touching with it, and people reuse it. I mean, so it's actually becomes a disease vector. Not only, it also inhibits breathing, so it can create hypoxia, which can create flu-like symptoms. It makes you ill if you wear a mask over the long term, and it's not good for your health, especially if you're exerting yourself. So they're asking people to do something that is explicitly unhealthy to fight a phantom. To do something that just doesn't even prevent you, is no efficacy in preventing the spread of any, you know, of any diseases, especially the mask they're saying to wear, because you walk in the stores, you see people wearing these things, and there's no standard for it. It's absurd. You see people walking, jogging wearing masks, or driving. Right. I mean, this is the type of mass stupidity. I think maybe because, you know, if you wear a mask, it deprives your brain oxygen, so it makes you stupid, so you keep wearing the mask. So.
Yeah, exactly. It's a vicious cycle. Yeah, and it was like, I forget where I was. I was walking around with somebody, and there was like, they had these people going, they weren't police. They were like, I don't even know what they were. They were like civilian something or others. I don't even know. But they're like, you need to wear a mask. And then there was some guy who was smoking a cigarette, and he's like, well, what if I'm smoking a cigarette? And they're like, no, that's fine. It's like, what?
Yeah, I saw a lady driving her car. Obese woman driving her car, and she's got a mask on. And I'm in the turn lane, so I'm right beside her, sitting for at the light, and she's beside me. And she pulls her mask down to take a puff of her cigarette and puts her mask back up.
It's just asinine. Yeah, no. Exactly.
And, oh, restaurants. Now the rule is you can go into a restaurant. This is in Michigan. Whitmore out there, the Wicked Witch of the Midwest. She's now instituted mandatory mask wearing in all establishments, restaurants. But you can take the mask off to eat, but you have to put it back on when you're finished.
I mean, yeah, it's just that's just asinine. I mean, none of it makes any sense.
And yeah, and again, I'll keep saying it. Like it
belies any kind of rational response to something. I mean, if these people are truly experts, then they surely know that it's all nonsense. I mean, and it's just
well, the moment. I mean, here's another thing: is if a governor issued a decree, none of these decrees are lawful. They really have no force of law. It's a bluff. Because they can't require you to wear a mask. And what they've done is they go into the businesses and they say, oh, I'll get your license if you don't do it. So the businesses will enforce it. But then again, under HIPAA, you can't require to wear a mask because if it's unhealthy, they can't make you wear a mask. And I would say it's not healthy to wear a mask because it inhibits breathing. Therefore, no one really is required to wear a mask. But if they were to say, let's require everyone has to wear, you know, Mickey Mouse ears out when they're outside. Would that be lawful? Would people have to do it? I mean, because you have to I can demonstrate that masks are unhealthy because it inhibits breathing, especially over the long term. So that's wrong. In court, you could demonstrate this, but they could not demonstrate the efficacy of general masks because no one can demonstrate how it prevents the spread of any disease. You know, so if you're charged, if someone gives you a 500, what you really need, you need like a Rosa Parks like situation where someone gets a fine, takes it to court, and under cross examination can prove that this thing is effective, and therefore these orders are arbitrary and capricious and have no standing or have no legitimacy, and therefore should be tossed out. These are unlawful orders. Same like the attempted quarantine that Cuomo was trying to impose. With New Jersey and Connecticut, you know, anyone coming from a high incidence state has to be quarantined for 14 days. He doesn't have the power to do that.
Right.
He doesn't want to have the power to collect the fine that he wants to impose. So it's like these governors and mayors have like claimed dictatorial powers under a false, you know, health crisis. But there's no basis for this. In the meantime, you know, Governor de Blasio, where New York falls apart, he's painting Black Lives Matter on Fifth Avenue. Yes. This is the nature of political leadership, in these states. It's you know, this is the quality of it. It's absurd. But this is where it's almost like Bolshevism. It's like Bolshevism. It's like political cultural terror, and they're as they preside over the collapse of their states and their cities. They're engaging in this cultural, you know, Bolshevism, terrorism, to, you know, destroy the communities. It's something to behold.
Yeah, it really is. It's harrowing, but also, again, they're pretty much cashing in all their chips right now, and so it's like, you know, people can see what their real priorities are. Again, if this is a serious thing, you're not going around and renaming streets Black Lives Matter. You're not going around and condoning mass protests. You're not walking around, you know, with sometimes wearing masks, different types of masks. I don't know if you saw the one. It was the lady who was like, I've come out with a new prototype, and it was like beads or something. And they were like, oh, this is just great. And it's like, excuse me, what? You know, it's a shit test.
It's also evil because I had a friend, he sent me, he has a 96-year-old aunt who's in a retirement home. She's been isolated. And it turns out that the spike in deaths, at least in New York and New Jersey, isn't a result of the coronavirus per se. It's a result of the isolation and the neglect these people suffered because of the lockdown.
Oh, wow.
And so what happens is you know, these people's lifeline are their relatives that visit them. Not only is it psychological, it's also physical because they make sure they're not being neglected. This is the reality of these retirement homes. And so when they were cut off from them, they were neglected. There's one person whose father died. He supposedly died of COVID, but really he died of dehydration.
Yeah, don't they pretty much mark anything?
Yes.
It's sort of like you can edit this out if it's too spicy, but it's sort of like a Holocaust survivor. I was alive during the Holocaust, therefore I survived. It's like the same thing with the disease, with the COVID.
Yes. Yeah. And now it's, well, and they admitted
that. But if you die, it's the opposite. So if you die, you died from COVID.
And they admitted to cooking the books. I make the George Floyd test for COVID-19.
Right. Yes.
I saw that.
So therefore he's a COVID death, and therefore Officer Chauvin should be let off scot-free then, because he was a COVID death.
Right.
Yeah. If it wasn't the heart attack from the fentanyl and whatever else he had in his system, it was COVID.
It was COVID. My friend sent me the instructions to go visit her, and they can't touch her. They can't, no hugging, and plexiglass separates them from her.
Good Lord.
That's ridiculous. I mean, what's the point of even living a few more days or months if that's your life? And again, all this over what? Again, what's going to kill her is the isolation neglect, not the disease. That's going to accelerate it, her death, and which is perhaps part of the objective. Obviously, those nursing home deaths spiked the death rate, and that's what they wanted. They wanted the higher numbers. So this is have you seen what they have planned for schools in the fall?
I saw some things. They're trying to do some remote learning or whatever it was, but not too much.
But for the people going to school, they're going to require mask wearing all day, which is unhealthy. Okay. For kids. Wow. This is for a group of people at virtually zero risk. And teachers unions are now saying in various states saying we can't go back unless you do this. So you're too afraid to do your job. So quit. I'm sure there'll be plenty of people who are unemployed who are happy to come in and fill those positions and take the risk. But this is a situation where public unions and these institutions are being used to maintain the illusion. The same way the mask is very important, because the mask maintains the illusion of a pandemic. It's psychological, and that justifies the continued lockdown, which achieves the objectives, the ultimate objectives of the Great Reset. So that's how it's all connected. Because you can't have people not wearing masks, get it going around. It's going to create too many questions. Just like in May with spring coming, people were getting out and doing things, and the narrative was collapsing. So they needed to spark race riots,
Right. Yeah, exactly. So,
this direction.
Well, anyway, it's 2 hours now. Instead of, you have anything else to say, or do you think we covered it?
I think we covered it. I would just urge listeners to go and pick up the books. It's The Way Life Should Be, through Ostara, Ostara Publications, and The God That Failed, Liberalism and the Destruction of the West. That's through Black House Publishing. Support, if you don't want to get the books, my books, go check those publishing houses out. They have a lot of good stuff. There aren't very many publishing houses that are specifically dedicated to our positions, or at the very least, like Black House, they publish all types of positions. Anyone who's willing to question neoliberalism, so I would definitely recommend those. The podcast is The Way Life Should Be, which will be through Free Atlantic Radio, and keep your eyes peeled. I do have a third book that I'm working on right now called Plastic Empire, which deals with the social control aspect, a lot of the media stuff and indoctrination. That'll be through Ostara as well, and hopefully at some point this year, later this year, that'll be out sooner rather than later, I hope. And then I'm looking forward to that getting banned as well promptly by the large retailers. But if you're intrigued by some of these things, as I mentioned, World Economic Forum, I talk quite a bit about them in the way life should be, I kind of got into some of the details there and that kind of thing. And what else? The anatomicallycorrectbanana.com. There's the blog. I'm publishing stuff mostly from other dissident writers at the moment, because I've been focusing on writing the books, but there's some really interesting stuff there from some different dissident authors. And as of right now, I'm not banned off of Twitter, and I'm at anatomicallyokay on Twitter, so you can follow me there until probably get booted off that at some point. They say it's the 10,000 threshold. Once you get to 10,000 followers, it's sort of like the Stalin thing. He would let any publications stay in circulation that had 10,000 or fewer. But if you get above that, it would be shut down. It's the same thing with dissidents on Twitter, I think.
Yeah, it's if what you're saying has an impact, then that's when you get in trouble. Otherwise, they can.
Yeah, I mean, I could get on and talk about the Denver Broncos or something. But it'd probably be fine. But yeah, calling out this stuff is, it's hazardous to your online health. You know, actually, one quick thing about that too, about the health. The people who are getting involved in this stuff and understanding what's going on and trying to find solutions to pushing back, so we can retake our sovereignty. I do recommend taking some time off and not totally immersing yourself in it. Like, it's sort of like weight training and exercise. You should take a day or two off a week where you just don't think about it at all, because you will drive yourself crazy.
Yes. And it's stress, and stress makes you sick.
Yep. So on top of, the real pandemic here is stressing about the pandemic.
I was just today was a beautiful day. I was driving out in a very pretty part of where I live, and it just makes you feel better.
It does. Yep.
Getting outside, getting that vitamin D.
Which is why they wanted you inside, locked in.
Yeah, because the vitamin D is so good for you. Yes. And it's not just, in terms of like having health, the internal health benefits, but also just your state of well-being, which is, your mental health, which in turn affects positively your biological health, your bodily health. So
yeah, and with children, I've 7 children, so I'm occupied with that and enjoying that part of life, and not just worrying about it. And quite frankly, I'm doing this because I really don't care about myself much more anymore. It's the future that matters, and that's where you get meaning anyway. That's where your will to live anyway comes from. That anyway,
right? But yeah, exactly.
They're going to deal with. I had my youth, in the halcyon days of the '80s and '90s. I like to see the next generation have some semblance of freedom and liberty and autonomy and some optimism, and they're trying to destroy that. And getting about, at the same time, people have to think of themselves as dissidents now. Too many people think the system's on their side, and it isn't. And I mean, this is for everybody who has a job, has a family, who's normal, who's responsible and lives a moral, healthy life. They are the dissidents just by nature of their existence and their outlook on life. And just not saying anything and being polite is no longer enough. As they say, silence is violence. So they won't even leave you alone if you don't say anything.
Absolutely. No, so, you're absolutely right.
So the days of just not saying something are over. Or will be over if there isn't some pushback. There's got to be some serious pushback. So, okay, well, listen, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
I'll post as soon as I do. I'll send you the link.
Yep, absolutely. And I will beam it out on the social media and hopefully get some ears.
Oh, sorry. When do you expect your new podcast to start then?
My hope is that the first one should go live on Thursday.
Okay.
I'm slotting in. Tom's kind of... He's doing a couple of, I think he's planning on like Monday, Wednesday, Friday for his show. And then I would slot in on a Thursday, if I'm not mistaken. And I'll send the link to you. I have to find it. He sent it to me on Telegram, and I can't remember where I have it, but I'll send the link along to you. It's going to be a whole, there should be daily programming during the week anyway, the work week.
Okay, and I guess you have a link on the anatomically correct banana, I guess, right?
I don't think I do yet, actually. I'm going to need to get on that.
Okay, there you go. Okay.
Good job, self-promoting job.
Okay, good. Jeez. Thanks so much, then.
Okay, yeah, I'll send it along to you.
Thanks, then.
All right, thank you. Have a good evening.
You too. Bye-bye. See you.